This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio Books presents Men in Black: How the Supreme Court is Destroying America by Mark R. Levin. This book bears a dedication for the Levin family, my wife Kendall, our children Lauren and Chase, my parents Norma and Jack, and my brothers Doug and Rob. Introduction by Rush Limbaugh. Mark F. Lee Levin has headed up the legal division of Excellence in Broadcasting for years, and for good reason. He is simply the best at what he does. He specializes in an area that is particularly close to my heart, constitutional law. Mark has eaten, breathed, and slept the United States Constitution since he was in junior high school. He loves history, especially American history, and is passionate about this nation's constitutional heritage. He and I share the belief that this is the greatest nation in the history of the world. Not because of our geographical blessings, and not even because of our diversity. America's greatness lies in the unique system of government established by the framers to maximize our individual liberties, which has ultimately led to our national strength and prosperity. Mark tells me he was so fascinated with our constitutional history as a young boy that he used to visit the various historic sites in Philadelphia, where our government was born, and early on began studying our founding documents. Through the years, his love of this carefully crafted system of limited government has not diminished in the slightest, and he remains committed to doing his part to preserve it and the freedom it guarantees. Mark doesn't just talk the talk, he walks the walk. That's why he serves as president of Landmark Legal Foundation, a superb public interest law firm dedicated to leading the fight to preserve America's founding principles. Landmark is the leading conservative law firm litigating for school choice, and is the National Education Association's most feared adversary. Landmark Legal serves as the conservative movement's top legal watchdog against government expansion and abuse, including taking on the politically correct Environmental Protection Agency. Landmark has been in the thick of the ongoing battle against voting fraud and has taken on the Internal Revenue Service. Mark served in the Reagan Justice Department under Attorney General Edwin Meese and has always been involved in the world of politics, mostly as a writer and pundit. Now he has his own very popular radio show on WABC in New York City, where he continues to champion the causes of limited government, the entrepreneurial spirit, and safeguarding America's national security. Given his strong belief in our constitutional system, which was designed to divide and diffuse governmental power between our federal and state governments and among the three branches of our federal government, Mark has been justifiably concerned over the years as these delicate balances have been eroded. He rightly sees an unaccountable activist federal judiciary as the primary culprit. Every honest observer of the political scene knows that since the 1960s, the judicial branch, led by the United States Supreme Court, has accelerated its already well-honed pattern of usurping the authority of the elected branches of government. Constitutionalists like Mark and me believe that the judiciary should stay out of politics and policy matters. Federal judges, and especially Supreme Court justices, all of whom are unelected and unaccountable to the people, have rejected their constitutional role. They increasingly legislate from the bench and rewrite the Constitution at will. Liberal apologists for this kind of judicial tyranny glibly protest that but for the activist Supreme Court, we would still be living in the Dark Ages on issues from slavery to civil rights. But it was the court that upheld slavery and segregation, setting back race relations in America for more than a century. Every time the court arrogates power that was properly left to the other branches, it chips away at our constitutional foundation. Every time the federal courts issue rulings over internal matters of the several states, they do lasting damage to our system of federalism, and thus to the rule of law and to our liberties. Besides, judicial activists have a very poor record. They are the ones responsible for upholding such detestable and unconstitutional practices as slavery and segregation. When a small group of men and women donning black robes makes decisions beyond its authority, it is disenfranchising the will of the people, which is properly exercised through the people's duly elected representatives. This trend must be reversed before it's too late. That's why Mark has written this incredible book, to set out in layman's terms the current state of our runaway judiciary and the threat it poses to our nation. Mark takes us through all of today's hot-button issues and the way they are being shaped by the Supreme Court. In each chapter, he gives us the history of the constitutional development of these issues, so that we understand exactly where we are compared with where we started and where we ought to be. This book couldn't be more timely or important, as liberals continue shamelessly to thwart the people, Congress, the president, and state governments. Increasingly, liberals are also denying the president his judicial appointment power by blocking his well-qualified appointments purely for political reasons. While the informed public, informed primarily thanks to conservative talk radio, understands many of the issues involved in this book, Mark Levin's Men in Black provides an indispensable historical and constitutional context, and it offers suggested solutions to remedy the serious problems we face. Let me tell you, folks, this is a subject in need of our urgent attention, and this book provides the ammunition you need to defend your liberty. I am proud to endorse this book by a constitutional scholar, a brilliant lawyer, a pundit extraordinaire, an exceptional radio talk show host, a patriot, and my very good friend. I hope it sells a million, and that twice that many read, absorb, and take to heart its critical message. Preface. Men, not gods. The biggest myth about judges is that they're somehow imbued with greater insight, wisdom, and vision than the rest of us. That for some reason, God Almighty has endowed them with superior judgment about justice and fairness. But the truth is that judges are men and women, with human imperfections and frailties. Some have been brilliant, principled, and moral. Others have been mentally impaired, venal, and even racist. Barely 100 justices have served on the United States Supreme Court. They are unelected. They are virtually unaccountable. They are largely unknown to most Americans, and they serve for life. They work in a cloistered setting, hidden from public view. Yet, in many ways, the justices are more powerful than members of Congress and the president. The Supreme Court today is involved in nearly every aspect of modern life, regularly vetoing the decisions of elected federal and state authorities. As few as 5 justices can and do dictate economic, cultural, criminal, and security policy for the entire nation. So who are these justices? Well, it's impossible to generalize, but here are some of the more stunning personalities who have served on the Supreme Court. James Wilson. Wilson was appointed by George Washington in 1789. He had been one of the more influential delegates at the Constitutional Convention, but had serious financial troubles after he was appointed to the court. He put his money into land speculation, fell into serious debt, and was put in debtor's prison. He once had his son pay off a creditor so that he, an associate justice of the Supreme Court, could be sprung from jail in Burlington County, New Jersey. Hounded by creditors, Wilson later left his native Pennsylvania and had to live a life on the run. After holing up in a series of dreary taverns, he died broke in North Carolina and was buried in an unmarked grave. John Rutledge. Rutledge, too, was appointed by Washington in 1795 by recess appointment and became the nation's second Chief Justice. A United States senator from Rutledge's native South Carolina wrote that after the death of his wife, his mind was frequently so much deranged as to be in a great measure deprived of his senses. There was considerable opposition to Rutledge's appointment, and he was voted down by the Senate. There had been rumors that his mind was unsettled and he was becoming insane. Rutledge's depression was so serious that he made two failed suicide attempts, one shortly before and one soon after the Senate rejected his nomination. Henry Brockholst Livingston. Appointed by Thomas Jefferson in 1806, Livingston had killed a man in a duel before his appointment to the court. Henry Baldwin. Baldwin was appointed by Andrew Jackson in 1830. In 1832, it was reported that he was seized today with a fit of derangement. Less than 2 weeks later, Daniel Webster alerted a friend to the breaking out of Judge Baldwin's insanity, and another correspondent observed more pithily that Judge Baldwin is out of his wits. Baldwin was hospitalized for what was called incurable lunacy and missed the entire 1833 term of court. Baldwin's colleague, Joseph Story, informed Circuit Judge Joseph Hopkinson in May 1833 that, "I am sure he cannot be sane, and indeed the only charitable view which I can take of any of his conduct is that he is partially deranged at all times." But Justice Baldwin nonetheless returned to active service on the Supreme Court and remained a voting member of the court for 11 more years until his death in April 1844 at age 64. Robert C. Greer. Appointed by James Polk in 1846, Greer suffered paralysis in 1867 and thereafter began a slow mental decline. Greer's case is most troubling because he was the swing vote in one of the most important cases of his era, Hepburn v. Griswold, which struck down the law allowing the federal government to print paper money. Greer's demonstration of mental incapacity during the conference discussion was such that every one of his colleagues acknowledged that action had to be taken. Nathan Clifford. Clifford was appointed by James Buchanan in 1858. After a period of mental decline, Clifford suffered a stroke in 1880, just before the beginning of the October term of 1880. Justice Miller described the situation bluntly. "Judge Clifford reached Washington on the 8th of October, a babbling idiot. I saw him within 3 hours after his arrival, and he did not know me or anything. And though his tongue framed words, there was no sense in them. Clifford kept his seat until his death in July 1881. Stephen J. Field. Field, appointed by Lincoln in 1863, was one of the longest-serving justices. As Chief Justice William Rehnquist has written, at the end of Field's service, he became increasingly lame and often seemed lethargic to his colleagues. During the winter of 1896 and 1897, his condition worsened, and his questions in the courtroom indicated that he had no idea of the issues being presented by counsel. Joseph McKenna. McKenna was appointed by William McKinley in 1897, and his mental faculties began to decline as he approached his 80s. After Chief Justice William Taft failed to convince McKenna that it was time to retire, Taft called a meeting of the other justices at his home. They decided they could not allow McKenna to cast the deciding vote in the court's decisions. From then on, they agreed that if there was a split vote among them, they would change their votes and not allow the case to go forward. The court did hold a few cases over until McKenna finally agreed to retire in 1924. James C. McReynolds. McReynolds, appointed by Woodrow Wilson in 1914, was a notorious anti-Semite. He said he didn't want the court plagued with another Jew. There is no official photograph for the court for 1924 because McReynolds refused to stand next to Justice Louis Brandeis, the court's first Jewish justice. He would leave the room whenever Brandeis would speak in conference. He was also openly hostile toward the second Jewish justice, Benjamin Cardozo. He often held a brief or record in front of his face when Cardozo delivered an opinion from the bench on Opinion Day. A McReynolds law clerk, John Knox, also wrote that the justice disapproved of the fact that Knox had been polite to McReynolds' African-American servants, Harry and Mary. McReynolds told him, "I realize that you are a Northerner who has never been educated or reared in the South, but I want you to know that you are becoming much too friendly with Harry. You seem to forget that he is a Negro, and you are a graduate of the Harvard Law School. And yet for days now, it has been obvious to me that you are, well, treating Harry and Mary like equals. Really, a law clerk to a justice of the Supreme Court of the United States should have some feeling about his position and not wish to associate with colored servants the way you are doing. I do wish that you would think of my wishes in this matter in your future relations with darkies." Hugo Black. Black, appointed by FDR in 1937, had been a member of the Ku Klux Klan in Alabama. He stayed on the court longer than he should have. In 1969, he suffered a stroke, resulting in a partial loss of memory. His health troubles became worse. In late March 1971, he started having acute pain in his left ear and a chronic headache over his eye and in the back of his head. Aspirin did not help. He found it more difficult to concentrate. His short-term memory was waning. He would latch on to some event of long ago and reminisce. In conference, he began to stumble badly, becoming tired and confused and unable to remember which case was being discussed. Black's mental decline seemed to lead to paranoia in the months before his resignation and death. Black was paranoid about the future, expressing fears of governmental collapse. Nixon was preparing a military coup, he said. "Anything can happen here. We have small groups fragmenting the government. There may not be a 1972 election. A dictator might take over." Felix Frankfurter. Frankfurter was appointed by Franklin Roosevelt in 1939. He helped launch the career of the notorious spy Alger Hiss. Frankfurter had been a prominent professor at Harvard Law School. Before joining the court, he had great influence in getting his law students prestigious clerkships for Supreme Court justices. A notable clerk he obtained for Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes was a student named Alger Hiss. At Frankfurter's urging, Hiss began a public service career that included service as a delegate to the Yalta Conference, where FDR, Churchill, and Stalin set the boundaries of post-war Europe. Hiss would later be named by Whitaker Chambers as a spy for the Soviet Union. He was tried for perjury, and Frankfurter, in an unprecedented move for a sitting Supreme Court justice, served as a character witness for Hiss at the trial, as did Associate Justice Stanley Reed, another FDR appointee. Although Frankfurter obviously would not have known of Hiss's eventual ties to the Soviet Union as a communist spy, he knew of the specific charges when he decided to lend the prestige of his high position to Hiss's defense. In Brown v. Board of Education, Frankfurter behaved in a manner that most legal ethicists would consider extremely troubling. He collaborated with a former clerk, Philip Ellman, who was serving in the Solicitor General's office in the executive branch. That's the office that represents the administration's position before the court. Frankfurter passed confidential information on to Ellman about the positions of his fellow justices in Brown and advised him on arguments the government should make to sway the court. William O. Douglas. FDR appointed Douglas in 1939. In a particularly bizarre episode, Douglas met a flight attendant on a plane and invited her to visit him at the court, where he allegedly physically assaulted her. Just a short time after she had entered Douglas's chambers, though, members of the staff began hearing strange sounds from inside, shouts, banging furniture, and running feet. A short time later, the office door flew open, and out rushed the young woman, her face all flushed and her clothing badly disheveled, shouting at the startled office staff how outraged and disgusted she was. Douglas, she said, had chased her around his desk, grabbing at her clothes and demanding that they go to a motel immediately for a sexual liaison. Douglas's marriages to young women and his subsequent divorces created financial hardship for him, so he sought income to supplement his court salary. One significant source of income while he was on the bench came from a questionable source. Newspaper reports had established that over the years Douglas had received $101,000 from the foundation of Albert Parvin. Parvin was the former co-owner of the Flamingo Hotel in Las Vegas and a business associate of Meyer Lansky, Ice Pick Willie Alderman, and others not usually placed within the category of nice Jewish boys. In his last year on the court, Douglas also suffered at times from delusion. A 1974 stroke incapacitated William O. Douglas at the age of 76 for 2.5 months. Although he told the press he had been hurt in a fall. Afterwards, he slurred his words, couldn't walk, developed fears that people were trying to kill him, thought he was Chief Justice, and spurned pleas that he quit. Things were so bad that the justices themselves took action. His refusal to step down, despite obvious mental and physical problems, led colleagues to decide secretly to stop counting his vote in some cases until he finally quit at the insistence of his wife and friends, some 10 months after the stroke. Charles Whitaker. Whitaker, appointed by Eisenhower in 1957, was said to be vacillating and indecisive. The pressures of the court led him to a nervous breakdown and retirement after 5 years of service. Abe Fortas. LBJ appointed Fortas to the court in 1965. He continued to act as an advisor to Johnson while on the court. He supplemented his court salary, $39,500 at the time, by taking money from a foundation set up by a convicted stock swindler. Fortas resigned from the Supreme Court after it was revealed that while on the bench, he had pocketed a $20,000 retainer from the foundation of jailed financier Lewis Wolfson. He found a cash cushion in a $20,000-a-year consulting fee from Lewis Wolfson, a Florida businessman who was under investigation by the SEC for alleged stock improprieties. In setting the terms for the fee, ostensibly to compensate him for occasional advice to Wolfson's philanthropic foundation and companies, Fortas arranged for Fortas's wife, Agar, to receive the $20,000 each year after his death. In exchange, Fortas had to attend a single annual meeting. And, of course, it was possible that one of Wolfson's cases would end up affected by a decision of the court. 2 weeks to the day after the first check was sent, Fortas was writing the White House to boost two of Wolfson's companies, both of which were under federal investigation at the time. It was a quiet deal, and became public only when Johnson tried to make Fortas Chief Justice in 1968. Fortas, finding himself facing impeachment rather than promotion, resigned. Thurgood Marshall. Marshall, appointed by LBJ in 1967, stayed on the court too long. In his final years on the court, he became indifferent to his judicial duties. He reportedly left much of the writing of opinions to his clerks and sometimes didn't bother to read the briefs submitted by counsel. Instead, he apparently spent many hours watching television in his chambers, especially soap operas. People magazine had called him a devotee of Days of Our Lives as early as 1982, and he once told fellow Justice William Brennan that you could learn a lot about life from soap operas. Despite the fact that he wasn't quite giving it his all, he didn't want to leave, since he would probably be replaced by a conservative. But despite poor health in recent years, his eyesight is failing, he wears a hearing aid, and he broke his hip in a fall last year, he was determined to keep his seat as long as the likely replacement was another conservative nominee. With cantankerous tongue in cheek, Marshall would tell his clerks, "If I die, prop me up and keep on voting." In his waning years, Marshall would disparage the framers of the Constitution. At a speech in Hawaii, he said in part, "I do not believe that the meaning of the Constitution was forever fixed at the Philadelphia Convention, nor do I find the wisdom, foresight, and sense of justice exhibited by the framers particularly profound. To the contrary, the government they devised was defective from the start, requiring several amendments, a civil war, and momentous social transformation to attain the system of constitutional government, and its respect for the individual freedoms and human rights we hold as fundamental today. They could not have imagined, nor would they have accepted, that the document they were drafting would one day be construed by a Supreme Court to which had been appointed a woman and the descendant of an African slave. We, the people, no longer enslave, but the credit does not belong to the framers. It belongs to those who refuse to acquiesce in outdated notions of liberty, justice, and equality, and who strived to better them." Marshall couldn't have been more wrong, and couldn't have had a weaker grasp of the Constitution. The Constitution established principles of governance. Discrimination, injustice, and inhumanity are not products of the Constitution. To the extent they exist, they result from man's imperfection. Consequently, slavery exists today not in the United States, but in places like Sudan. Indeed, the evolution of American society has only been possible because of the covenant the framers adopted, and the values, ideals, and rules set forth in that document. Many truly great individuals have served on the Supreme Court. Many great rulings have been issued by the court. But the justices have been frequently and wrongly deified. They have co-opted authority that has not been granted to them. They have usurped the authority that has been granted to Congress, the President, and the states, and they continually behave like an Olympian council. Men in Black, which refers to the men and women who serve as judges and justices on the federal bench, tells the story of how America has turned from the most representative form of government to a de facto judicial tyranny. From same-sex marriage, illegal immigration, and economic socialism, to partial birth abortion, political speech, and terrorists' rights, judges have abused their constitutional mandate by imposing their personal prejudices and beliefs on the rest of society. And we, the people, need not stand for it. Chapter 1. Radicals in Robes. The American people will never be able to regain democratic self-government and thus shape public policy until we curb activist judges. Edwin Meese III, Attorney General of the United States under President Ronald Reagan. America's founding fathers had a clear and profound vision for what they wanted our federal government to be. They created a Republican government strong enough to protect and nurture the young nation, but at the same time, one limited in scope and size, so that it could not squelch states' prerogatives or stifle their citizens' liberty. The overarching purpose was to prevent the concentration of power in a relative handful of institutions and individuals. With respect to the federal judiciary, the framers also had definite intentions. They wanted a central court system free from the political pressures of the legislative and executive branches of the government, with a narrow role and limited authority. A judiciary that respected, applied, and preserved the rule of law and the principles of popular sovereignty enshrined in the Constitution. Were our forefathers to view the American federal government of this 21st century, I believe they'd be appalled. Activist judges have taken over school systems, prisons, private sector hiring and firing practices, and farm quotas. They have ordered local governments to raise property taxes and states to grant benefits to illegal immigrants. They have expelled God, prayer, and the Ten Commandments from the public square. They've endorsed severe limits on political speech, and they've protected virtual child pornography, racial discrimination in law school admissions, flag burning, the seizure of private property without just compensation, and partial birth abortion. They've announced that morality alone is an insufficient basis for legislation. Courts now second-guess the commander-in-chief in time of war and confer due process rights on foreign enemy combatants. They intervene in the electoral process. The Supreme Court, in particular, now sits in final judgment of essentially all policy issues, disregarding its constitutional limitations, the legitimate roles of Congress and the President, and the broad authority conferred upon the states and the people. The Court has broken through the firewalls constructed by the framers to limit federal and especially judicial power. The plain language of the Constitution should govern judges when rendering constitutional decisions. Judicial decisions should not be based on the personal beliefs and policy preferences of a particular judge. Judges are appointed for life because they're not politicians. And because they're not politicians, they're not directly accountable to the people and are not subject to elections. They have a different role, which is to search for answers to the issues presented to them based on what the Constitution and the law compel. They have a duty to approach their responsibilities with restraint. Their decisions carry the weight of law and can have far-reaching consequences. When a judge strays from this obligation, he undermines the very structure of our Constitution, disenfranchises the people, and inserts into law subjective opinions that often lead to inconsistent, illogical, and flawed results. The Constitution defines and establishes the distribution of authority, the structure of government, and the process by which national decisions are to be made. Generally speaking, judges tend to adhere to one of two philosophies. Too few judges keep their sworn oath to uphold the Constitution. Those who do look to the text of the Constitution and the intent of the framers when deciding a constitutional question and believe they are bound by them. These judges are known as originalists. Too many judges consider the Constitution a document of broad principles and concepts, one that empowers them to substitute their personal beliefs, values, and policies for those enumerated in the Constitution. They see their role limited only by the boundaries of their imaginations. These judges are activists, or non-originalists. Originalists believe that the powers enumerated specifically in the Constitution are the only powers of the federal government, unless the Constitution is formally amended. Originalists generally interpret provisions of the Constitution and, when applicable, statutes narrowly. In other words, these judges attempt to look at the plain meaning of the law. They believe in a clearly delineated separation of powers. My friend Robert Bork summed it up well when he said that originalism appeals to a common sense of what judges' roles ought to be in a properly functioning constitutional democracy. Judges are not to overturn the will of legislative majorities absent a violation of a constitutional right, as those rights were understood by the framers. Moreover, judges may look to the text, structure, and history of the Constitution, but are prohibited from inventing extra-constitutional rights. Originalism seeks to promote the rule of law by imparting to the Constitution a fixed, continuous, and predictable meaning. Originalists object to the judiciary grabbing power in the name of advancing a social good or remedying some actual or perceived injustice. To the extent that this framework is compromised, both liberty and the rule of law are jeopardized. The judiciary, operating outside its scope, is the greatest threat to representative government we face today. A judicial activist, on the other hand, construes the Constitution broadly and rejects some of its provisions outright, or gives them superficial acknowledgement if they interfere with the desired outcome. In essence, activist judges make rather than interpret the law. They substitute their will for the judgment of deliberative bodies. They see their role as doing justice or righting wrongs, when in fact they're doing neither. They're no more just or wise than the next guy. Judicial activists simply use their high positions to impose by fiat that which should be determined through the democratic process. Four landmark decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court stand out as examples of the terrible consequences that can arise when activist Supreme Court justices substitute personal policy preferences for constitutional imperatives. The cases of Dred Scott v. Sanford, Plessy v. Ferguson, Korematsu v. United States, and Roe v. Wade, which I will discuss in a later chapter, are all examples of judicial activism. In these four cases, the court either ignored the clear mandates of the Constitution in favor of a desired result, or usurped legislative authority. These decisions had tragic and far-reaching consequences. Dred Scott was decided in 1856. It is one of the most infamous cases in American history. Scott was a slave whose master, an army surgeon, had taken him to posts in Missouri, Illinois, and what is now Minnesota. When Scott's master died, Scott was inherited by his widow. But, encouraged by white friends, Scott sued for his freedom on the grounds that he had lived so long in free territory. The questions before the court were whether Scott was a citizen of the United States with a right to sue in federal court, whether prolonged residence in a free state had made him free, whether Fort Snelling, part of the Louisiana Purchase, now in Minnesota, was free territory, and whether Congress could enact a law that banned slavery in the land acquired in the Louisiana Purchase. Chief Justice Roger Taney wrote the majority opinion and ruled that because Scott was not a citizen of the United States, he did not have standing to bring suit. Taney argued that when the Constitution was ratified, citizenship was perfectly understood to be confined to the white race, and that they alone constituted the sovereignty in the government. Thus, blacks were not citizens. The opposite, however, was true, as Abraham Lincoln pointed out in a speech on June 26, 1857. Lincoln cited the dissenting opinion of Supreme Court Justice Benjamin R. Curtis, who showed that in 5 of the then 13 states, to wit, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, and North Carolina, free Negroes were voters, and in proportion to their numbers had the same part in making the Constitution that the white people had. In other words, the facts Taney used to support his conclusion were simply wrong. As for Scott's residence in free territory making him free, Tony rejected that argument, but with little explanation. He devoted only one page of his 55-page opinion to the subject. On the final point, Tony concluded that the Fifth Amendment prohibited people from being deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process, and because slaves were property, any congressional ban on slavery in the territories of the Louisiana Purchase was unconstitutional, because it would be a denial of property without due process. But Tony's ruling ignored Article 4 of the Constitution, which, as Professor Michael McConnell, now a federal judge, has pointed out, vests in Congress the power to adopt all needful rules and regulations for the governance of the territories. And nothing in the language or history suggests that decisions about slavery are an exception. Under traditional canons of constitutional interpretation, the court should have given effect to the Missouri Compromise and declared Dred Scott a free man. Tawney presumed, in McConnell's words, that a statute can be unconstitutional because it violates unenumerated rights. In this case, an unenumerated right to slavery. With typical activist flair, Tawney overruled Congress's power to ban slavery in the territories and imposed his own view on the nation. McConnell quotes Justice Curtis's dissenting opinion in Dred Scott. When a strict interpretation of the Constitution, according to the fixed rules which govern the interpretation of laws, is abandoned, and the theoretical opinions of individuals are allowed to control its meaning, we have no longer a Constitution. We are under the government of individual men, who, for the time being, have power to declare what the Constitution is according to their own views of what it ought to mean. This is precisely the problem we face today. In 1896, in Plessy v. Ferguson, the Supreme Court examined the constitutionality of a Louisiana law requiring railway companies carrying passengers in their coaches to provide equal but separate accommodations for the white and colored races. The law was challenged under the 14th Amendment, which prohibits the states from making or enforcing any law which shall abridge the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States, or shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, or deny to any person within their jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. The majority, led by Justice Henry B. Brown, upheld the constitutionality of the Louisiana statute. Brown wrote, "We cannot say that a law which authorizes or even requires the separation of the two races in public conveyances is unreasonable, or more obnoxious to the 14th Amendment, than the acts of Congress requiring separate schools for colored children in the District of Columbia." In Plessy, an activist Supreme Court upheld a state law that mandated segregation and forced a private industry, in this case the railroads, to separate individuals on account of race. By failing to invoke the plain language of the 14th Amendment, the court inserted its own segregationist version of what was just. Like Dred Scott, the court's decision would have terrible consequences. The doctrine of separate but equal was the law of the land for the next 58 years, until the court reversed course in the 1954 decision, Brown v. Board of Education. In 1944, in Korematsu v. United States, the Supreme Court upheld executive orders issued by President Franklin Roosevelt establishing military authority for the forced internment of Americans during World War II. The court's opinion, only some 20 pages long, was devoid of any legitimate constitutional basis for upholding Roosevelt's orders. More than 110,000 law-abiding individuals, mostly Japanese Americans and Americans of Japanese ancestry, were removed from their homes on the West Coast, relocated to camps in the interior of the country, and detained without cause. The Fifth Amendment states that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. If this wasn't a violation of the Fifth Amendment, then what is? Rather than applying the clear language of the Constitution, this activist court simply upheld FDR's policy. Indeed, the court dismissively concluded that war demands sacrifices and that certain groups will have to bear certain burdens. Given the sheer inhumanity of these decisions, it is difficult to understand why so many regard the Supreme Court as the most moral and just of the three branches of government. These cases are crucial to understanding the danger inherent in judicial activism. When the judiciary utilizes outcome-determinative reasoning rather than adhering to the Constitution, the result can be catastrophic. Activist Supreme Courts have justified slavery, segregation, and racism. They helped precipitate the Civil War and set back race relations for more than a century. But instead of learning the painful lessons of the past, that the Constitution must guide their approach to the law, several current Supreme Court justices are no less committed to judicial activism. Recently, Justice Anthony Kennedy, in a 2003 speech to the American Bar Association, spoke out against federal mandatory minimum sentencing laws that the courts and Kennedy are obliged to uphold. "I can accept neither the necessity nor the wisdom of federal mandatory minimum sentences. In too many cases, mandatory minimum sentences are unwise and unjust." Kennedy again decried the federal sentencing guidelines in testimony before the House Appropriations Committee when he said, "I do think federal judges who depart downward are courageous." This is a remarkable declaration. We have a Supreme Court justice praising judges who violate federal law, and almost no one noticed, and even fewer cared. I doubt Kennedy would be so complimentary about lower court judges or legislators defying his court's rulings. The late Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, when asked about his judicial philosophy, stated, "You do what you think is right and let the law catch up." Marshall deserves credit for his bluntness. Many judicial activists shroud their approach in bogus legal constructs. Marshall didn't. When Congress or state legislatures pass laws with which a large segment of the public disagrees, the people have numerous outlets for recourse. They can lobby their representatives, raise funds to run advertisements encouraging their fellow citizens to get involved, organize grassroots movements, participate in voter registration drives, and, above all else, support or oppose candidates for public office based on their viewpoints. But if the Supreme Court issues a decision holding unconstitutional, say, a federal statute prohibiting partial birth abortion, as it did in the 2000 case Stenberg v. Carhart, there is precious little tens of millions of citizens who oppose this grievously brutal procedure can do to influence that decision. It has been handed down from on high, wrapped in constitutional language by justices who are appointed for life and institutionally immune from accountability. When judges come between the people and their representatives, they frustrate representative government and poison the body politic. So many of the nation's most far-reaching and contentious issues are now determined by judicial orders, increasing the public cynicism about government and apathy toward voting. And when justices ignore their sworn obligation to uphold the Constitution, they destroy the very rule of law they claim to enforce and undermine their own credibility and legitimacy. But the judicial activists remain undeterred. Indeed, Supreme Court justices are increasingly relying on international law, not the Constitution, to justify their approaches and actions. Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in a speech discussing the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which she described as the foundation document for contemporary human rights discourse, complained that the United States Supreme Court did not have the same readiness to look beyond one's shores as other nations. She said, "The U.S. Supreme Court has mentioned the Universal Declaration of Human Rights a spare 5 times, and only twice in a majority decision. Nor does the U.S. Supreme Court note the laws or decisions of other nations with any frequency." She continued, "When Justice Breyer referred in 1997 to federal systems in Europe, dissenting from a decision in which I also dissented, the majority responded, 'We think such comparative analysis inappropriate to the task of interpreting a constitution.' In my view, comparative analysis emphatically is relevant to the task of interpreting constitutions and enforcing human rights. We are losers if we neglect what others can tell us about endeavors to eradicate bias against women, minorities, and other disadvantaged groups." Ginsburg has written that a too strict jurisprudence of the framers' original intent seems too unworkable. She added that adherence to our 18th century Constitution is dependent on change in society's practices, constitutional amendment, and judicial interpretation. She later remarked that boldly dynamic interpretation departing radically from the original understanding of the Constitution is sometimes necessary. Anthony Kennedy. Kennedy referred to international standards when examining Texas sodomy laws in the 2003 case Lawrence v. Texas. The sweeping references by Chief Justice Berger to the history of Western civilization and the Judeo-Christian moral and ethical standards in a 1986 Supreme Court case Bowers v. Hardwick did not take account of other authorities pointing in an opposite direction. A committee advising the British Parliament recommended in 1957 repeal of laws punishing homosexual conduct. The Wolfenden Report, Report of the Committee on Homosexual Offenses and Prostitution, 1963. Parliament enacted the substance of those recommendations 10 years later. Sexual Offenses Act, 1967, No. 1. Of even more importance, almost 5 years before Bowers was decided, the European Court of Human Rights considered a case with parallels to Bowers and to today's case. An adult male resident in Northern Ireland alleged he was a practicing homosexual who desired to engage in homosexual conduct. The laws of Northern Ireland forbade him that right. He alleged that he had been questioned, his home had been searched, and he feared criminal prosecution. The court held that the laws prescribing the conduct were invalid under the European Convention on Human Rights. Kennedy continued, "To the extent Bowers relied on values we share with a wider civilization, it should be noted that the reasoning and holding in Bowers have been rejected elsewhere. The European Court of Human Rights has followed not Bowers, but its own decision in Dudgeon v. United Kingdom. Other nations, too, have taken action consistent with an affirmation of the protected right of homosexual adults to engage in intimate, consensual conduct. The right the petitioners seek in this case has been accepted as an integral part of human freedom in many other countries. There has been no showing that in this country the governmental interest in circumscribing personal choice is somehow more legitimate or urgent." Sandra Day O'Connor. Here's Justice Sandra Day O'Connor lecturing about the importance of international jurisprudence on the court, especially in the future. "Although international law and the law of other nations are rarely binding upon our decisions in U.S. courts, conclusions reached by other countries and by the international community should at times constitute persuasive authority in American courts." She added, "While ultimately we must bear responsibility for interpreting our own laws, there is much to learn from other distinguished jurists who have given thought to the same difficult issues that we face here." Moreover, Justice O'Connor has referred to international law in one of her books, The Majesty of the Law, Reflections of a Supreme Court Justice. In the chapter titled Broadening Our Horizons, she wrote, "Nevertheless, I think that American judges and lawyers can benefit from broadening our horizons. I know from my experience at the Supreme Court that we often have much to learn from other jurisdictions." She goes on to say, "As the American model of judicial review of legislation spreads further around the globe, I think that we Supreme Court justices will find ourselves looking more frequently to the decisions of other constitutional courts, especially other common law courts that have struggled with the same basic constitutional questions that we have: equal protection, due process, the rule of law in constitutional democracies." O'Connor recently ratcheted up her rhetoric in a speech at Georgetown Law School. "International law is no longer a specialty. It is vital if judges are to faithfully discharge their duties." John Paul Stevens. In 2002, in Thompson v. Oklahoma, Stevens referred to international standards for the execution of criminals under 16 years of age. "The conclusion that it would offend civilized standards of decency to execute a person who was less than 16 years old at the time of his or her offense is consistent with the views that have been expressed by respected professional organizations, by other nations that share our Anglo-American heritage, and by the leading members of the Western European community. Thus, the American Bar Association and the American Law Institute have formally expressed their opposition to the death penalty for juveniles. Although the death penalty has not been entirely abolished in the United Kingdom or New Zealand, it has been abolished in Australia, except in the state of New South Wales, where it is available for treason and piracy. In neither of those countries may a juvenile be executed. The death penalty has been abolished in West Germany, France, Portugal, the Netherlands, and all Scandinavian countries, and is available only for exceptional crimes such as treason in Canada, Italy, Spain, and Switzerland. Juvenile executions are also prohibited in the Soviet Union." It is as if many of these justices will rely on anything but the Constitution to guide their decision-making. And there's a reason for this. The court has so fundamentally altered its duties and so completely rejected the limits placed on it by the Constitution's checks and balances and enumeration of powers that the justices are in an endless search for extra-constitutional justifications and inventions to explain their activism. The power they crave does not exist in the Constitution, which is why they must constantly skirt its provisions. Reliance on international law is a complete rejection of not only the roles of the other branches, for these are not decisions or laws reflective of their deliberations or actions, but the Constitution itself. Judicial activists are nothing short of radicals in robes, contemptuous of the rule of law, subverting the Constitution at will, and using their public trust to impose their policy preferences on society. In fact, no radical political movement has been more effective in undermining our system of government than the judiciary. And with each Supreme Court term, we hold our collective breath, hoping the justices will do no further damage, knowing full well they will disappoint. Such is the nature of judicial tyranny. Chapter 2. Judicial Review. The Counter-Revolution of 1803. This member of the government was at first considered as the most harmless and helpless of all its organs, but it has proved that the power of declaring what the law is, by sapping and mining slyly and without alarm the foundations of the Constitution, can do what open force would not dare to attempt. Letter from Thomas Jefferson to Edward Livingston, 1825. So how did America reach the point where the federal judiciary has amassed more influence over more areas of modern life than any other branch of government? From which section of the Constitution